This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Coquitlam peoples.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicos. Today is December 16th, 2021, and this is episode 270.
I'm Strat Lonneboom.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, we'll get into Omicron, the latest COVID, of course, and responses or lack thereof, the NDP's convention, the provincial one that is. Federally, we'll look at fiscal updates and mandate letters and a few other bits and bobs as we get into it. This is probably our last show for 2021 because I look at my holiday plans and have so much happening, even though everything is terrifying. And I have a baby coming, so I may just like disappear for a couple months.
Plus, it's the slowest 2 weeks of news of the year.
Yeah, the last few years we've always tried to do something around the holidays, but it's such a, I don't know, I'm just tired, I think, this year. Sorry, listeners. Go back and listen to our Star Wars holiday special from a few years ago.
I think that was 2017. That was when The Last Jedi had just come out. So that was
We're not updating it for Rise of Skywalker. That adds nothing to the politics of Star Wars.
No, in fact, it takes it away and just makes it more confusing. That was a bad movie.
Let's talk politics. First, of course, thank you to everyone who contributes to the show. If you want to join them, get in our Patreon Slack. We'll still be there talking about anything that comes up. Join us at patreon.com/politicoast. First, though, let's touch on the last time we'll touch on the greatest BC premier bracket in 2021. We'll come back to it in 2022. Last time we looked at the second half of the BC Liberal semifinals, we put Duff Botello, the last of the independent Liberals, against Gordon Campbell, the first of the new BC Liberals, and somewhat of a surprise to me. I thought there might have been more hostile feelings towards the man. Gordon Campbell won 18-15, another close race in the BC Liberal corner. I think it was the racism that did in Botello, though. We don't like our racist premiers, and that's fair.
Could be, or we don't like the bridge that bears his name and the nerve-wracking experience that has scarred many a driver trying to get across.
To bring us forward, we are going to skip one step in the bracket to introduce two premiers who we've not talked about yet. The final two we need to, and I don't think this will be as contentious of a race, so I don't mind putting it over the holidays. It'll still only be a 1 week chance to vote. But we are going to talk about the other two BC NDP premiers, the ones who got a bye from the first round, Dave Barrett and Dan Miller. First, let's talk about Dave Barrett. He was the 26th premier from September 15th, 1972 to December 22nd, 1975. Famously, in his words, he was there for a good time, not a long time. Dave was a Jewish social worker who he describes his father as being a Fabian socialist and his mother as a communist who voted CCF. They had moved to Canada from Russia, and Dave went on to get a university education and then got involved in politics. He got first elected in 1960 to the BCCCF banner, and he ran for the provincial leadership of the NDP, which it became shortly thereafter in the mid-60s. I imagine he was encouraged to by the popularity he was developing and his general charm and charisma. He was quite the charismatic figure in BC history. He didn't win that initial leadership race. He lost to Tom Berger. Berger was expected to win the 1969 election, but didn't, and resigned as leader. Barrett was then basically anointed and would go on to win the 1972 election, which I find a fascinating bit of trivia because it sounds like how John Horgan became premier. Although he was more forced into it because no one else wanted the job after Adrian Dix lost the 2013 election. So Barrett goes on and leads the first NDP government in BC history. He wins 38 seats with 39.6% of the vote, as the WAC Bennett-led Social Credit won only 10 seats with 31% of the vote. Much of theirs was split off by the Liberals, who took 16% and 5 seats, and the Progressive Conservatives, who took 12.7% and 2 seats. You see here, the right splits, the left wins. the Social Credit were also running a really bad campaign filled with gaffes. One in the top of the Wikipedia article notes that Phil Gagliardi, who was a minister, a cabinet minister in Bennett's government, told a newspaper before the campaign started that WAC Bennett was probably going to resign shortly after the election, even if he won, because he was, quote, an old man who doesn't understand what is happening with the young people of the province. Vote of confidence for your leader. Can you imagine a minister saying that about a sitting premier or prime minister?
These days would be rare. It's been a long time since there's been that level of sniping going on between ministers and their party leaders.
At least publicly.
You kind of miss it, though.
Like, yeah.
Politics has gotten so...
sanitized.
Sanitized. There's too much party discipline. You get none of the fun stuff that would be, fun to talk about on shows like this.
Yeah, so Dave Barrett wins, and the famous story is that he gets around and he meets with his caucus and he just like jumps on the table and shouts, are we here for a good time or a long time? And they all yell back, good time, because they were so stoked to win that they just wanted to really revolutionize the province. Right at the end of the campaign, WAC Bennett had declared the socialist hordes are at the gate of British Columbia. Barrett wasn't a full socialist, but he was probably more left than we've had in a long time. So many of the things British Columbians know as like big institutions in this province are legacies of the Barrett 3 years. The Labor Relations Boards, ICBC, the Agricultural Land Reserve. Hansard didn't exist until 1972. We just didn't write down what they said in the legislature until that point. The Human Rights Code was brought in by Dave Barrett. He launched the initial form of pharmacare. He banned corporal punishment. He also banned pay toilets. So if you like your free poops, thank you, Dave Barrett.
I'd feel better about that if they'd actually then followed up with building out a bunch of unpaid public toilets. But now it's just hard to find one, a public toilet one way or the other in a lot of Vancouver, which isn't great.
That's fair.
I totally get why they pushed for it, but it also feels like one of these pretty classic unintended consequences lessons.
He also established the air ambulance service, consumer protection laws, French immersion in BC schools. During his 3 years in power, they passed 367 different bills. That was a new law every 3 days of sitting, I believe. So they went quick. They broke things. They got a little ambitious, and in 1975, thinking he could get another majority, Dave Barrett called a snap election, but he lost to Bill Bennett, who had taken over the SOCREDs and really reconsolidated the free market coalition. The BC NDP had also run into some challenges with labor support. There was a couple moves that he made that ran them against unions who were hoping for more. I know there was almost also some controversies where some of his caucus members who were hoping he'd go farther on women's rights were disappointed. And the classic NDP story of they didn't appease everyone in their party right away and they couldn't get that far in the next election. It was interesting, though, in 1975, though, their support actually did increase in the popular vote, but it was just that reconsolidation of the creds that really meant they had more votes. The NDP also bled a little bit of support outside of Vancouver, so they concentrated and first past the post just worked against them. As well, he didn't win as many votes as the SOCREDs. In the 75 election, Barrett lost his seat, but he would stay on as leader and he would win a by-election. He moved from Coquitlam, I think, into Vancouver. He remained an MLA until 1984. Famously, in 1983, he was dragged by the sergeant-at-arms from the legislature during debates over austerity where he got too heated. And I think that's one of the few times in Canadian political history where a politician had to be forcibly removed from debate.
I'm sure there are other cases. They aren't sprinting to mind at the moment.
And Barrett would go on to federal politics in 1988, being an MP for a Vancouver Island riding. And he would run for the federal NDP leadership in 1989, ultimately losing to Audrey McLaughlin. There is a few anecdotes out of that. We can get into those later, but that's the Dave Barrett legacy. Most people who know the NDP history in BC will know Dave Barrett and probably have very strong affinity towards him. I'm putting him up against Dan Miller, the premier you probably forgot about. Exactly. And he's not even one from the ancient era. This was the 32nd premier from
I was alive at the time. I was nine, but still.
August 25th, 1999 to February 24th, 2000. 6 months. He was technically only the interim leader of the BC NDP. He was appointed after the resignation of Glenn Clark and left office upon the party choosing Ujjal Dosanjh to take over. 6 months as an interim leader, there's not much you can say about the guy. He was from, I think it's at Port Alice, but he was a counselor in Prince Rupert and a millwright. He was elected in 1986, and he held a lot of different cabinet posts in the governments of Harcourt, Clark, and even Dussange. He was Minister of Forest, then Labour. He was Deputy Premier to Glenn Clark. And Wikipedia just describes him as an uncontroversial and moderate politician. So I think if you make a list of BC premiers who've not lost election, died in office, resigned in disgrace, or gone down in corruption, or somehow haven't left office on their own terms. Dan Miller is one of the few who, he didn't fully leave on his own terms, but he didn't get chased out of office. So he had a very clean time as premier, even if it was for only 6 months, and I can't name you a single thing he did as premier. I can tell you that his chief of staff was one John Horgan, who would go on to be our premier today. Dan Miller did not seek re-election in 2001, which was probably good because he probably wouldn't have won based on the fact all but two NDP MLAs won. Maybe you hate Dave Barrett and just want to see him go down, but you can go to Politico's pod on Twitter and vote in this round, or politicos.ca/bracket. No ill will to Dan Miller. He was premier for 6 months during an interim role. Omicron BC, it's here. It's doubling every 3 days, it seems like, in the Vancouver Coastal Health Region. COVID's back. COVID's bad.
Oh, never really left.
No.
It feels different than it did 6-8 months ago, for sure.
Feels different than it did 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
What do we have to say? Everything is the same. The federal government's response has been ham-fisted and all over the place. The provincial government does a seeming response at this point, other than people should get vaccinated, which is true, but
that's maybe even being a bit generous to the province's response at the moment. At best, there seems to be, we are really concerned about this. We're not really going to do anything. We'll put some advisements out. Don't expect us to go as far as breaking out the box cutters to get some rapid tests distributed or anything.
There's so many different little angles, and the federal government's response was initially to ban flights from South Africa and a select specific countries, basically the only countries where it had been identified, but it was identified in South Africa, as we've quickly figured out, because they're looking hard. They're looking probably the hardest for new variants.
Yeah, they just getting punished for it. They have a really good sequencing program there in a way that the European countries where it may have originated from just didn't. I believe it was Botswana, one of the other countries that had an early detection of Omicron. Their first three cases were three European diplomats coming in. So yeah, not a great go-around for travel restrictions this time. Being generally supportive in the past, because I do think there is the opportunity, if you do them well, to at least buy some time and get prepared for some of the stuff and prevent the introduction of some of these variants if you can help it. That was not what happened here, because the detection was late and very poorly targeted.
Yeah, and a good travel restriction, even if the variant is here, can buy you time by turning off the taps of more of coming in, but we just picked countries that seemed like they would have more COVID and or more Omicron, and here we are. So there's lots to criticize there.
And yet they're talking about bringing in more restrictions, which at this point has really seems like trying to close the barn door after the horses have fled.
Yeah, so we now have a travel advisory on international travel, so don't go out of country for the holidays. Yeah, I get that there probably shouldn't have been much travel. It's also frustrating. I'm just frustrated. Provincially, I don't know, do you want to start with rapid tests, where it's just become the embarrassment and confusion?
The punchline?
So we have an excessive amount of rapid tests in warehouses compared to some provinces.
Yeah, so the federal government procured a bunch of rapid tests and distributed them to the provinces. Most other provinces, you can go get rapid tests. They're fairly hard to come by here and basically just had very limited distribution to nursing homes, and then they're just not widely available. And people have been wondering why, and earlier this week we got an answer on that. Turns out the government is having problems unpacking them.
So we've gotten a bunch of answers, but let's unpack this answer first. The logistics is always a challenge, right? When you're in a pandemic and your health system is stretched, you have finite number of hands, finite number of bodies, and do you want to take people off the front lines to open the boxes that these were shipped in from the federal government to then do something with, but you don't know what you're going to do with yet? So I get that there's a challenge in terms of logistics, but we have plenty of other examples. Like, it's been widely pointed out, Nova Scotia did a massive call out for volunteers because it's not a particularly skilled task.
Yeah, and there are tens of thousands of government employees. Presumably, they're not all working night and day trying to manage the emergency responses to the last emergency we were talking about and the new Omicron troubles, who could be retasked with some stuff. Also, provinces have called in the military in the past for support during times of crisis, and if there's one group that is really good at logistics, it's them. The point is, between how Nova Scotia handled it, other ways we could have handled it, it's a solvable problem, and it's, well, frankly, makes the NDP look entirely incompetent that they haven't been able to figure out how to get tests out of boxes and to the people who need them.
So I think it's less, I think that's an add-on excuse. I think the fundamental excuses are the other ones that we've been given, which is that they don't want to use them, essentially, for a variety of reasons that have seemingly changed. And I've seen some analysis trying to question some of those from different experts. But the idea is rapid tests aren't, they're not a silver bullet. They have problems relative to the drive-through PCR tests, the like standard nose or gargle test you would do to get your COVID test. They can have high false positive and high false negative rates, and that can result in people, particularly the false negatives, thinking they're not with COVID, but then still spreading it. Now, obviously, you just have to factor that into your rollout strategy, because having some, we have enough, we can do something with them.
Yeah, and it really depends how you look at it. If you see this as a, okay, what's better, that someone gets a PCR test or someone gets a rapid test? Yeah, the rapid test is going to do a worse job at determining whether that person has COVID. But at the same time, you miss 100% of the cases you don't test for. And that's where the rapid test can actually make a difference, is not by displacing PCR tests, which, by the way, you can't get one if you're not symptomatic, or which is its own
set. You're not supposed to get one if you're not symptomatic, but they're not really checking, Scott. Let's
Yeah, people can lie when they go in to get one. But the point is,
they don't even ask, but
I've always been, every time I've gone, they've asked if I've had symptoms.
Here in Coquitlam, they're just like, you're here for a test. It's over there.
Huh. Yeah, no, they're in Vancouver Coastal Health. They are screening more heavily for people getting PCR tests. But yeah, the point is, if you're thinking of them as a substitute for PCR tests, yeah, that's bad. Outside of the cases where speed really is much more important than accuracy, which are probably fairly few and far between. But the point is, you naturally just test people a whole lot quicker and cover a wider area and use it as another layer in the defense. Because you don't want, defenses generally work best when they're layered and you aren't relying on a single point of failure or a single piece of it to carry all the weight.
Another aspect of the provinces, and this is mostly Dr. Bonnie Henry, I suspect these decisions are largely being made by public health just based on the way they're coming about. I don't think the NDP has a real dog in the fight either way. But the other aspect of the excuse has been that the tests are generally to be administered by a medical professional. And it's not just that it's what it says on the box, but some of them require devices to read, or so it's claimed. So it's not just as simple as here's your bag, stick it in your nose, put it on the spot and see if two red lines pop up or whatever. You need an extra device. But that I've also seen challenged by some experts who've actually looked at what the federal government says they've shipped us versus, and it's somewhat true that it sounds like we don't have all of the perfect tests, and the province is claiming we're expecting better tests to arrive in the next month that then they'll start to do more things with. And hey, they're announcing a rapid testing strategy on Tuesday, so maybe all of our complaints and concerns will be alleviated then. But it's just been frustrating to watch different jurisdictions respond entirely different and not really have a clear and consistent and good transparent answer here about why, like, Ontario is giving rapid tests out freely at a bunch of facilities across hotspots and also sending one home with every school kid over the holidays. And while BC is just, yeah, we're going to save them.
Something on Tuesday is better than nothing, but we're what now? This is, what, week three since the variant was detected? Maybe week two? I don't know. What is time anymore? But the point is, the time to have done a rapid test strategy is well before the Tuesday before Christmas in the second year of the pandemic. Actually, technically, I think we're in the third year now, because it's been the two-year anniversary of the first COVID case has already passed. But regardless of that depressing note, you just gotta wonder why, after all this time, we're still doing the reactive half-measures thing rather than actively trying to be out in front of this stuff and addressing it before it becomes a problem, and politically before it becomes a headache, and before it makes the government look like idiots for not knowing how to open some boxes. It's altogether just baffling.
Or maybe we'll just do Ontario did for last Christmas, and we'll have a lockdown for boxing.
Maybe. That's the way things are going. That wouldn't surprise me.
So dumb. That was so bad. Because it obviously say that, let COVID. No, I'm not saying
we won't
do it.
It looks like we're on track for the same thing here. So
I know. This is why I'm frustrated and tired.
Yeah, because, yeah, so far we've got concern from the government and Bonnie Henry, but no real changes to how things work. There's an encouragement to have smaller gatherings that at Christmas time, but no drastic cutbacks on how large events can be, not changing any of the stuff around that. So you just...
I'll clarify, we're recording this on Thursday evening at 8:40 p.m., and there is a press conference scheduled for Friday at 1 p.m. with Bonnie Henry and Adrian Dix. So maybe we'll be totally out of date and Christmas will be canceled, in which case, just laugh while you're listening to us be wrong. But we're still frustrated.
Even if that is the case, I will still take them to task for not moving very quickly on this and being, well, slower than they should be.
I did look back, and in last year, it was early November when the first regional restrictions were introduced to stop that wave. And it was December 7th when they did basically the province-wide lockdown, no religious gatherings, Christmas is canceled announcement. So we're behind that schedule, although we didn't know at the end of November Omicron was coming. But
the other area where I think BC stands out against what other provinces are doing is the booster shot. So Ontario announced that starting Monday, any person over the age of 18 who's had their previous doses can book an appointment for their booster shots. Here, we're still in the dark on what's happening. I don't know, maybe that'll be part of tomorrow's press conference, but you look on the BC government's website on this, all they say is sometimes 6 to 8 months after your last dose, which is vague and not particularly reassuring in terms of when the timeline is going to be on that, which is not great. And I would sure appreciate it if they could give me a firmer timeline on when I can get the shot that can take my current vaccination from 30% effective against Omicron, which seems to be where the numbers are sitting now, to back around 80% or so.
Clarity would be nice.
Yeah.
I'm not as desperate that we have boosters for everyone, because I'm still frustrated that Canada is like, when do we get our third shot when much of the world is still waiting for its first, and it's self-defeating in the long run to keep fighting it here without that broader thing. But as a province, we don't really have control over that. And so just having that,
if we have the doses, we might as well get them out.
And so that's my question. It's how many doses do we actually have? How much are they being taken up? Because if they, because our third doses are going out, but they're just focused still on the older priority populations, who we do have more of than many other provinces. We do have more elderly and at-risk people because people like to retire in BC because it's a nice place to come. But it makes it a challenge. Transparency is the thing that
yeah,
we could always have used more of.
Yeah, I hit the six-month mark on January 3rd, and I would really like to know if I'm going to get my booster around January 3rd or as
you
late
will
as
not.
At this point, I think it's pretty likely that the answer is no on that. But, you know, it's 8 months, that means March 3rd. And that's not a short amount of time, particularly during a new wave and when seasonality is likely to make things worse on its own anyway. So.
Wear your mask, not wash great. Your hands, stay home, people, if you can.
And just the final note on this, and just one final note before we move on from Omicron, you know, the provincial governments are not the only ones responding to this, and federal politicians are starting to stake out their positions, including the opposition parties. The NDP, led by Jagmeet Singh, have announced what they want to see the federal government do, which is free rapid tests for Canadian. Well, have Trudeau work on free rapid tests for Canadians, accelerated booster strategies, healthcare work recruitment blitz, and 10 paid sick days, which, I mean, most of that stuff sounds fine, but it would sure be nice if he could pick up the phone and call his fellow party member, John Horgan, and actually hash out what the NDP's position on all of this is, because the actual NDP governments are not seeming to follow that particular set of policies, considering what we've talked about on, well, booster shots, rapid tests, and the 5 paid sick days we're getting here in BC.
I love watching the different NDP messaging, like the Rachel Notley opposition in Alberta is constantly criticizing, which is deserved, the Jason Kenney UCP response to COVID. But a lot of their messaging almost contradicts what BC is doing. You're not wrong. The party is separate parties in many ways, even though it's officially one. And we see that quite regularly. Maybe they can just justify it being the challenge of governing versus the challenge of opposition. But one thing that is going well for this government is their recent convention that ended this past weekend. The NDP has to have a convention every so often and go back to its membership and find out how it's doing and what they want to see happen. And like most parties these days, they manage the shit out of the thing so little controversy arises. But there's still a little bit of controversy at this one. But I want to start by talking about probably the most interesting thing to come out, which there wasn't that much, let's be real. But in any of these conventions, especially when a party is in leadership, there's a leadership review vote. And there's always this question of what percentage do you need to win in a leadership vote to stay on as leader? Technically, in most bylaws, it's 50% plus one.
The Joe Clark rule puts it a little higher than that. He famously stepped aside, what was it, a 70, let's say 79%? I can't quite recall the number. But it was in the 70s, and he felt that wasn't a strong enough mandate from his party to stay on and step down. And ever since then, that's been an unofficial rule that if you get below 80%, you're done and need to make room for new leadership.
I think it was 75% for Joe Clark. And it comes up because in Alberta, both premiers Ed Stelmach and Alison Redford got, I think, 77 or 78%, and they didn't resign because of that very shortly after the discontent in the province forced them out of office, and they both did end up resigning on 70, 77% results. Tom Mulcair famously didn't get 50% and is one of the few to actually be forced out by the rules. The question comes up for Aaron O'Toole in the upcoming leadership race. It comes up for Jason Kenney in his current leadership battle. Jason Kenney might just go with, I guess he can't go with too low because then he risks a splinter group and then the NDP wins. But for John Horgan, 2017, right after forming government, he got 97.5%. In 2019, it had dropped to 96.4%.
I am really curious who are the 2.5% who saw the government, the NDP win government for the first time in 16 years. And like, nope, can't have that happen. We need someone
else. They're the true socialists, or the ones who hate the Greens so much. They're like, you should have done better. You should have done better than a legislative tie, basically. This year comes around. It's been a bit rougher. It's been a bit longer. John Horgan gets 83%, which is more than I was talking about with that Joe Clark, that Ed Stelmach, that Alison Redford number. It's enough that I don't think anyone, he better resign. He clearly doesn't have the support, but it does show discontent.
Yeah, so 17% of the party doesn't want him there, which...
Of those who showed up, we should be
clear. Of those who showed up. But let's assume it's relatively representative. That's still significant. It's not that far off from 1 in 5 party members being unsatisfied with the leadership. It's strong enough that there isn't going to be calls to resign or anything, but it's not a good trend for him, for sure.
And I think the thing I've been thinking about, and I've seen a few rumors around, is just the question of, no one's pushing him out, but when will John Horgan want to resign, if he will want to step down? And I think the clearest way to think about it is, like, when is the opportune time for him to leave on his own accord? Because you don't want to leave a month before an election, or in the 6 or 12 months before an election, and you don't probably want to leave in the 6 or 12 months right after an election, or that looked that you won. And so that kind of puts him maybe in the next year in that first window to potentially resign if he doesn't want to face another election, or if he does try to face it, he's got to look at another 4 to 5 years of being around. And given that he's doing, it sounds like he's doing well from his cancer treatment, which is fantastic, but that wears on you. Governing during a pandemic and multiple emergencies has to wear on you.
Yes, health challenges mean this would be a natural exit point for him from public life that would, I think, generate a lot of understanding from British Columbians, and would, he seems relatively popular, as we'll talk about, but would be not a bad way to go out, all things considered, compared to some of the alternatives.
And it doesn't have to be in the next month or two, because it would be weird for the governing party to be in a leadership race at the same time as the official opposition.
That would actually be hilarious.
And right after, I guess it's not right after, the BC Greens also went through one, but suddenly Sonia Fursenau would be the most senior leader in the House, which is a very weird change from 2017. Anyway, we're both on pro-NDP leadership convention next year, if only for the content.
Yeah, it would be good content, for sure. And I've certainly heard from several different places rumors of people starting to think about whether or not they might want to run, should there be a leadership race within the BC NDP. So definitely something to keep an eye out. And I don't know, when you get to the point where there's leadership rumors, things can get interesting, if for no other reason than people wanting to start to position themselves for a run.
And it just becomes that self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I don't think we're ever going to get, at least with the current arrangement, into a Martin Krichan type situation, but it'll be interesting.
Yeah, as far as I can tell, like, no one in cabinet wants him to go. I don't get the sense that there's animosity in this cabinet in the way there has been in many governments. Like, they all get along, even if they wouldn't have all done the same things the same ways. There's definitely not an open animosity. And I don't even get a sense there's a, like, begrudging animosity, even in caucus.
Yeah.
If
anything, I get the feeling the animosity is more from the activist-based people than the...
Oh, yeah.
Anyone who actually works in Victoria in any capacity for this government.
And beyond caucus and the party base, the Georgia Strait released this poll by Stratcom, who has worked for the NDP in the past, and it seems like it's a leak, but maybe it's not a leak. They polled 803 people in BC, and they found that 51.1% of British Columbians had a positive favorability view of John Horgan, 15 0.6% of that very favorable. This compares to 22.5% for Shirley Bond as the interim BC Liberal leader and 24% for the BC Green leader, Sonia Firstenau. So he's got a 2-to-1 advantage in favorability over the other leaders, which isn't surprising for a premier, but it's just like a strong number of people, like a majority of British Columbians like the guy.
Yeah, like I would expect that would generally hold true to more or less no matter how you slice it, unless you're getting into some very specific subpopulations of the province. He's a likable guy, just personally it seems, and I think probably a strong asset for the NDP in that respect. The fact that he just appears like a kind of normal suburban dad and not has taken the kind of more abrasive activist parts of the NDP kind of off the table or away from the public consciousness in a way that has very much benefited the NDP. And something that when he eventually does leave the position, the NDP is going to have to grapple with. And just like anecdotally, when I'm talking with liberals in kind of spaces where liberals are discussing things, I don't get the sense that John Horgan is particularly disliked. It's almost always, complaints are almost always phrased against the NDP rather than the premier specifically, or against whatever cabinet minister happens to be in the news for doing something disagreeable.
Yeah, the poll also found 50% of people said they'd vote NDP, 30% BC Liberal, and 16% BC Green. The poll was done in early November, so before the flooding, and it was over the same point when he talked about his cancer diagnosis. So, like, maybe numbers shifted following the flooding, but despite our criticisms, I don't think that's true. So I think he's in a strong position.
I would hope it would. That situation would take the shine off the NDP a bit, just because they really did screw that up. And you would hope that there would at least be some negative feedback associated with that.
A few other things happened at the NDP's convention. There were a bunch of resolutions that passed that were unsurprising and really have the "why are you debating this? You obviously all agree" kind of motion sense about it. Universal child care, housing affordability, union certification, making sure wealthy people pay their share, implementing UNDRIP, supporting LGBTQ2S seniors. I'm glad the NDP are telling us they like these things, because I wouldn't have known if the members hadn't probably voted 80-90% in support of all of these things.
Yeah, it's a little silly in that respect, in that, yeah, NDP supports typical NDP positions. There's something to be said, though, for kind of the team building, kind of identity reinforcing aspects of that, though. So, like, I don't begrudge political parties from, you know, doing the things that emphasize how much they're all on the same side with stuff.
Yeah, you know, the one thing that
tribalism does have its benefits when it comes to organizing a group to do stuff.
The one thing that was a little more controversial at the convention was whether delegates would support the government on Clean BC. Ultimately, they did. 83% supported Clean BC. But a few delegates, led, it sounds like, by North Island representative and chair of the party's Standing Committee on Economy and Environment, Ashley Zarbatani, moved a motion to send the Clean BC resolution back to the committee to add a clause calling on the government to stop subsidizing fossil fuel companies. Basically, the idea that the government should not be subsidizing oil and gas while trying to bring forward a climate emergency plan, which is something that's a fairly common view, I think, and I'm quite sympathetic to. That motion to refer that and add the stop fossil fuel subsidies ultimately lost, with it only getting, I think, about 38%, with 62% voting to keep the original resolution. And that I find interesting, like the way these conventions are structured, very few controversial motions tend to make it up to the floor. Any local constituency association can submit a resolution and then they get prioritized in different ways, generally hashing out or pulling out the least controversial ones and focusing on those, at least at NDP conventions. And this tactic of trying to amend it is an interesting one from a procedural perspective for me, because it tries to go, look, we had a bunch of motions to call on the government to stop fossil fuel subsidies, and none of them made it to the floor. So we're going to try and mess with one of your own resolutions to put it our way. And the fact they got 38% support is embarrassing for them, but it's also somewhat of a sign of organization, since they beat the, well, they didn't beat the party apparatus, but they did manage to get some weight there. And I'm curious to see how much momentum they can build for a future convention, even though these resolutions are utterly meaningless when it comes to what governments actually do, we've learned.
Yeah, governments really don't care about these that much. They want to avoid the embarrassing headlines at the conventions. But platforms, government policies, they get written by the people in the minister's office or the campaign war rooms. And nobody flips back through kind of the minutes from the last convention to really just dig out exactly what should be in the platform or the throne speech or anything. So they will ignore a resolution if they don't see it in their political interest, like the one that passed in support of adopting the housing reforms from the expert panel on the future of housing supply and affordability. We talked about this when it came out. It was a good report. There was a lot of good ideas for reform in there. The BC NDP saw the call for getting rid of the homeowners grant and shut the whole thing down that instant. And I would wager a large amount of money that that is more or less going to be how they're going to deal with this particular resolution.
Yeah, I remain open to being surprised, but
they're not going to do that.
I think that's all I really want to highlight. I'll just also note that the party also ratified its new president, Aaron Shumahetsa, who's the former chief of the Lower Nicola Indian Band, and I think becomes the first Indigenous political party president in BC, if not Canada. Although I might be wrong about, like, maybe a Green Party has had one or there, but it's still noteworthy, and I think it's a good step forward. So, congrats. Let's jump over to federal politics. Trudeau is doing things. We have a fiscal update. We have mandate letters. It only took them, I don't know, time has no meaning.
Well, months. The election was what, September? Several months later now? About 3 months, basically, since the election?
It's amazing, because some of these mandate letters actually have to say, and the Minister of Attorney General and Minister of Justice and Attorney General has to say, now that one of the bills you worked on has passed, make sure you implement it. But let's start with fiscal update. It's just an update. It's not the full budget. It's not the full picture, as Chrystia Freeland told us. What were your takeaways, if any?
I was a little surprised to see them talk so much about pandemic spending. Obviously, with what we just spent the last bit talking about with Omicron, it makes a lot of sense. But I would have guessed they would have focused more on the cost of living and inflation stuff, which isn't entirely absent from there. But my expectation was that going to be the focus of this, and it wasn't.
Yeah, the bill, or the update, includes a lot of new, not a lot of new spending. It outlines $30 billion in recent and future pandemic spending, with $4.5 billion specifically for Omicron. There's $5 billion in flood relief. Basically, it's like a partially good news budget or update from the government, as the economy's doing a lot better on most metrics that they wanted to see, like tax revenues are higher than predicted, so revenues are up.
I mean, a little bit of that is good. Part of the tax revenues are up, to just inflation's up, so the
still makes their deficit the look less bad.
Yeah, the thing you're multiplying the GST by is just bigger.
Inflation's not uniform across the sector, so not every thing is being hit by it. But yeah, revenue is up. That means the deficit was potentially going to be down, but that opened up more spending. It's overall pretty positive for the government because they can say, look, we're managing the economy. No one has a balanced budget, or no one should have a balanced budget reasonably in this kind of situation. The spending is pretty popular, focusing on things like vaccine procurement, therapeutics, rapid tests, extending some of the subsidies, although there's criticism over like the fact one of the CERB or CRB has now been replaced by the lockdown subsidy. So you only get that if your province is in an actual lockdown, which none are. And who knows if any will be. Quebec is like the closest, but even there, it's not a full lockdown. So that seemed like a pointless move. Just get rid of the subsidy entirely if that's what it's going to be, because now you're incentivizing provinces to lock down. Is that what they wanted? The government is making choices.
I wouldn't necessarily say their economic picture is quite as rosy as made up to be. There's the cost of living stuff that is going to, I think, continue to haunt them a bit. And yeah, some of the immediate kind of metrics are looking okay on that, but economic policy has never been this government's strong suit or even area of interest for the most part, and I would like to see more signs that they're thinking in terms of what to actually do to generate long-term economic growth, which is just something they haven't done for 6 years, and in that respect, it's unsurprising to see that it was missing here, but also would be very nice if it was included.
Let's talk about the mandate letters then. We didn't go through every single one of them. A lot of it did seem to just be rehashing the Liberals' platform, which does beg the question of why this took so long to do. You may as well have just said, we're not going to do it. Although there were public stories about ministers asking for them, which starts to get embarrassing.
It's not a that's a bad sign when that has to happen.
Publicly, that is. Some notable ones. Where do you want to start? I pulled these out in the order they are in the actual list, which we took a weird amount of time to look into. We think it's the Prime Minister, Deputy Prime Minister, then order of precedent, which let's not get into. That's too esoteric even for us. Should we just start with the Heritage Minister?
Yeah, might as well, because that's going to be something that will definitely be a source of controversy in the upcoming parliament.
Yeah, so new Heritage Minister Pablo Rodriguez is tasked with, among many other things, reintroducing legislation to reform the Broadcasting Act to ensure foreign web giants contribute to the creation and promotion of Canadian stories and music, and swiftly introducing legislation to require digital platforms that generate revenues from the publication of news content to share a portion of their revenue with Canadian news outlets to level the playing field, and to model this on the Australian approach introduced, So the Broadcasting Act reforms were pretty controversial in the last parliament. The Liberals did pledge to reintroduce them. Hopefully they'll do it better.
Yeah, in particular, the social media regulation parts of it were very controversial and very poorly handled by then-Minister Stephen Gabeau.
Yeah, and the second half of this is an interesting move. I think this is the idea of taxing Facebook in some way or mandating Facebook pay post-media.
It would basically be I think the way the Australians do it is it's basically a fee every time Facebook or Twitter or something grabs an excerpt from a link that's posted.
Ah, the link tax.
Something like that. Which isn't without controversy. It was a pretty foundational part of the early internet and the resulting culture that emerged out of it, that there was no cost to linking.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how the debate unfolds when it hits the floor of the House, and maybe we'll get into it more then.
It's the online harms bill that I'm expecting to actually be the real thing in this portfolio that's going to generate the most controversy.
Yeah, that's the third thing I flagged, which is that Rodriguez and the Heritage Ministry are going to be tasked with working with the Minister of Justice to introduce legislation to combat serious forms of harmful online content and hold social media platforms and other online services accountable for the content they host. But to also do so reflective of feedback they've received, because they've heard an earful from people justifiably concerned about online harms, but also justifiably concerned about free expression implications. And I don't know anyone who knows what's going to happen. There was like a technical proposal previously released involving some ombuds people being created and some new offices to oversee it, but I don't know what will happen. And we're also going to launch a cultural diplomacy strategy with the Foreign Affairs Ministry.
This just seems like peak liberal soft power policy type stuff. Like, it's not a bad idea. I probably would have tried to think about it not as a cultural diplomacy thing, but as a cultural industries export. And like, we made some decent Canton here. Some of the stuff's not great, but there are definitely good cultural products that we make. Letterkenny, Schitt's Creek. I could list them off just as examples. We should be trying to export and use that as a revenue generator for the country. I'm not sure so much about the vague cultural diplomacy stuff, but yeah, if we can get Letterkenny streaming in every country, I think that would be a win for us.
My favorite part about the Schitt's Creek story is how little it involved all our structures actually working the way they're designed to. It almost succeeded despite the efforts to promote CanCon. But that's
which like is entirely unsurprising to anyone who's been a critic of CanCon.
That's a long debate for another time. Let's move over to the Attorney General, David Lametti. He's tasked with working to bring forward measures to counter the rise of ideologically inspired violent extremism and strengthen the capacity of Canadian police and prosecutors to bring justice to cyber criminals, terror suspects, to the fullest extent of the law.
That's vague. A little bit. The cyber criminals thing's interesting because sprinkled throughout several of the mandate letters, Attorney General, Minister of National Defense, Public Safety, I think at least one other one. Oh, Foreign Affairs, too. I think it was Foreign Affairs. Cybersecurity was something that popped up again and again, and we talked a bit about it last week, too. This is clearly something the government sees as an issue to tackle that was not on the radar during the election at all, and is also interesting in that this is not a government that has been particularly security conscious in any real way. So an interesting signal of a change of direction, or at least a waking up to the realities of the world's less nice aspects.
I don't disagree with any of that. I flagged this one as well because the phrase ideologically inspired violent extremism is like open enough that violent extremism in Canada in the last few years has been predominantly of one ideology or one group of ideologies on the far. And so when the government goes vague on here, I do worry about overreach and what kind of mechanisms they'll use.
Well,
especially when they're tasking it to the Ministry of Attorney General, where he might change the criminal code. And often it's a matter of, are we using the code and the tools within it, or are we just creating new laws for the sake of creating new laws?
So to steel man this a bit, I could see this as a case of you don't want to be focused solely on fighting the last war, the thing that is currently on the radar, and miss the next big thing that's going to cause problems, and avoiding being overly prescriptive in a mandate letter is one way to try and avoid that issue. Because, yeah, absolutely, extremism has been the biggest problem, violent extremism in Canada in the last several years, but that may not always be the case, and it's, I think, important that there isn't just a doesn't just get focused on that and we miss the next thing.
The Attorney General is also tasked with ending gun violence by introducing, quote, red flag laws, which are laws that allow the removal of firearms if a person is a threat to themselves or others, particularly their spouse, increase maximum penalties for firearms, trafficking, and smuggling. Basically, just really ramp up the gun control.
Yeah. I think there was already some provisions that allowed, might have been the chief firearm. It's been a long time since I've looked into this, but I thought there was some methods in place to remove firearms from people considered a danger.
You'd know better than I do. I don't know the... in terms of the gun laws, better.
Like
than
I said, it's
I
been
do,
a long but, time yeah. since I've looked at those in detail. But
there's a lot else in there. I'm conscious of our time. Over in national defense, obviously, the focus is on fixing the disaster that is the Department of National Defense, ending sexual misconduct in the military by doing everything it takes, frankly.
Yeah, that was a fairly significant portion of the mandate letter. Also, some other stuff more focused on the actual defense part rather than fits in some of the internal cultural problems. So they want to work with the U.S. to expand cooperation on continental defense and Arctic security and modernizing NORAD. So we're going to get an updated Northern Warning System, new Northern and Maritime surveillance technologies. They talk about modernizing the CF and NORAD to deter and defeat aerospace threats in North America. Interesting, no mention of replacing the actual equipment that is going to be the pointy end of the stick on that. The fighter jets. Shipbuilding, though, that gets its own section, but the Air Force's aspect of this is conspicuously absent from both this and the procurement minister's letter.
One thing we are going to be getting in terms of procurement is over in the Department of Transportation. They are going to launch a procurement process to move forward with high frequency rail, not high speed, not high velocity, high frequency, just lots of trains between Toronto and Quebec using electrified technology, at least.
Yeah, I've ridden the Via Rail between Toronto and Kingston several times, and more frequency would not be wasted, but nevertheless, it does feel pretty half-assed to do that and not just go high-speed rail. You're putting a lot of investments in there in the corridor. Might as well actually do the thing that will get the most out of it and actually get a high-speed rail line built in the part of the country where it would have the strongest business case.
And among the many other things, like the most specific thing I pulled out of transport as well, the only like project named, nothing about SkyTrain, I'm sorry, listeners, or BC in general, other than just building roads and rails so they can survive the climate that we now find ourselves in, is we apparently need to repatriate the Quebec Bridge. And this led us both down a Wikipedia rabbit hole. The Quebec Bridge is a national historic site that is owned by Canadian National Railway.
Which does raise the question what they're repatriating it from if it's owned by a Canadian company, but...
are they renationalizing it?
It was weird language. Rehabilitate, now that makes a lot more sense because it's not in the greatest state of repair and it's now over 100 years old and could almost certainly use significant refurbishment and rehabilitation.
It's a pretty big bridge, too. It's a big steel cantilever bridge outside Quebec City.
It's also a fairly historically significant one. A lot of the engineering regulations came out of the disasters related to the collapse of the bridge during construction and the fatalities that resulted there. It's a story every engineer has
had to look. Right, that's the bridge where the rings were supposed to come from, but
they don't. The rings are stainless steel and the bridge is not, because bridges are not built out of stainless steel because that would be prohibitively expensive.
Finally, over in immigration, there's a lot there about meeting the targets they've set out previously and some reforms. One I noticed in particular is they want to make the citizen application process free for permanent residents who have fulfilled the requirements needed to obtain it. And this led me down the rabbit hole of looking up what the current fees are. And it says the fee for citizenship is $630, which is not nothing.
Yeah. The for residents who have fulfilled the requirements to obtain it is interesting phrasing there. Does that mean if you file your application fee but don't have the requirements, you still have to pay $630 to have it rejected?
It's vague enough language that the requirements needed to obtain it, I'm not sure if it applies to, if the it applies to citizenship or the free part. Is it only free for people who meet requirements to get it for free? I don't think that's how it should be read, but I almost could read it that way. Anyway, I hope they do eliminate the fees for citizenship and immigration seem to get out of control in many countries. I know people who try to immigrate to a country and spend thousands on fees, and it's just a way to milk foreigners and discourage it. It limits immigration to only the wealthiest or those with job opportunities who tend to be more well off. So yeah, getting rid of these fees, I'm in big favor of. So I hope that moves forward. There's lots else in there. We'll link to all the mandate letters. You can read them yourselves. But let's close off on one quick take because I want to talk about this story because it's so good. Fetz wants its whiskey back.
They should just get for their Christmas. Whiskey back.
They should. Fetz is so good. Or was.
It's a great spot. I have not been there since before the pandemic, so I can't speak to the current status of Fetz. But yeah, it kind of sucks that they had their whiskey taken because of we have really dumb and outdated liquor laws in this province where you can't buy liquor even if the government central distributor won't sell it to you because it's a specialty liquor.
Yeah, this is one of the... We talked about this way back in 2018 when the NDP was recently elected. They were only a year in, and they like sent their goons in and seized 242 bottles of whiskey without a warrant. It's $40,000 worth of liquor. The owners, Eric and Allura Fergie, are now suing in the BC Supreme Court and are awaiting a ruling, hoping to get their whiskey or $40,000 back. And yeah, that would be nice because like maybe it was seized legally and I just want them to get it back because I'm sympathetic to their cause. An unjust law should not stand.
Yeah, the policing operation that seized the stuff was codenamed Operation Malt Barley, and that is just so cheesy. I think they should just have to give it back to make up for such a just a corny operation name. It's too on the nose.
Happy holidays, everyone. We'll see you in 2022. Raise a glass this New Year's, but not a glass of whiskey.
And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. Support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Politicoast is a production of Legend Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Wash your hands and stay home. Thanks for listening.